Welcome to Serial City, a podcast of stories, serialized and self-contained. On each show, we welcome guests to complement our day's selection. A discussion of breakfast cereal turns up in each show. Serial City is produced by the Midwest Centric Publishing imprint Maintenance Ends. Welcome. Here is Todd Kim.
This episode's story, The Blossom Watchers by David Vardaman. Here's author, publisher Rick Harsh to introduce us to this unusual story. David writes some extraordinary short stories, short novels, and he's a very difficult writer to describe. The easiest way to describe a writer is to compare him to someone. And Vardaman has been compared by just one reviewer as, well, he says, intimations of Beckett, Ionesco, both of those I agree with. Such, I don't know if I agree with that. Burroughs, to a degree, and Kafka, yes. But he's Vardaman. Imagine that combination, Ionesco, Beckett, and Kafka, and a guy born in Iowa and now living in Maine. Well, he's a good friend of mine, and I thought, shit, man, he's got a book, An Angel of Sodom, a book of one extraordinary short novel and 13 short stories. A terrific book. I was amazed, but he's actually a very good reader, and he manages to somehow, well, capture himself, which is a harder thing to do than you might think. He gets at the bizarre better than any writer I know uses the bizarre. You never know what's going to happen in a Vardaman story, and he reads it in a completely engaged way, and yet detached enough that the bizarre has room to resonate, and then he passes it by, and you're kind of left shaking your head and listening to the next part, wondering what's going to happen. Extraordinary writer, an extraordinary story, an amazing concept, more transparently constructed story than some of Vardaman's. The main theme was echoed, but not in a way you would ever expect.
The Blossom Watchers. Mr. King's son married Mr. Feynman's daughter. "We should get married too," Mr. Feynman said to Mr. King. "Do you mean to each other?" "I was thinking more of ladies." "Oh, of course," Mr. King said vaguely, as if he had just remembered about ladies and propriety. Mr. King was nearly an innocent, and propriety a thing he had constant need to be reminded of. Mr. Feynman was more a man of the world, and the existence of ladies was naturally, as you'd expect from a man of the world, on his radar. He had been to a number of foreign countries and noticed the ladies in each of them, and had much to say about them. He told Mr. King about the ladies of Italy, Greece, Spain, and Germany. Mr. King nodded along, but had nothing to add. He had never traveled, and even if he had, he would not have had much to say about ladies, either individually or as a group. He was not adept at lumping things together, nor was he adept at separating and categorizing. He did not know how to pigeonhole. "I like ladies," Mr. Feynman said, "because I like round and soft." "How do you feel about round and soft, Mr. King? Do you like a curve, an hourglass, the pendulous?" Mr. King was bewildered by this series of questions about shapes and textures. He said he liked things that festooned, but he was thinking mainly of tinsel garland and strings of cranberries and popcorn. As for Pendulous, he had enjoyed taking a whack at the occasional piñata. He liked whirligigs and kaleidoscopes too, but was at a loss to make them pertinent to the conversation, the subject of which, underneath it all, he suspected was male lust. "What kind of woman was your late wife?" Mr. Feynman said. "Alice threw the javelin and I did the shot put. She was a champion, but I got dizzy and broke my elbow. Besides not liking to twirl that many times and sometimes losing count, I found the little ball very heavy." "My wife looked good in leopard," Mr. Feynman said. "If I could have gotten her real leopard, I would have, because a classy lady like my Corrine deserved real leopard." Mr. King thought better of telling Mr. Feynman that Corrine was a homonym for a word that in vaudeville days meant a cheap chorus girl. After all the hoopla surrounding the wedding events, Mr. King and Mr. Feynman did not meet again for several months. Mr. King had given up all hope that Mr. Feynman would call him and suggest they go out for a cheeseburger or to a sporting event. This was just as well. Nothing was further from Mr. Feynman's mind than calling Mr. King to suggest they meet for a cheeseburger or a sporting event. His daughter's marriage had given him the idea, and he spent several of those intervening months out looking for a lady. He forgot completely about any Mr. King, even though his daughter was married to one, and had the King name tacked onto her real name. It didn't matter what her new name was. Mr. Feynman still called his daughter Sugar Choo Choo, the pet name he'd given her the first time she smiled up at him from the bassinet. The two men met again at a night blooming serious party, hosted by their children. As soon as Mr. King entered the apartment, he located Mr. Feynman, and he went to him to shake his hand. "All this time I have been intensely interested in seeing you again, Mr. Feynman," he said.
"Is that so? Can you tell me why?"
Mr. King rocked back and forth from his heels to the balls of his feet several times and blushed.
"They tell me this cactus blooms only one night in the year."
"That's true," Mr. Feynman said. His gaze drifted towards some of the dozen or so other guests. Mr. King grieved, already losing Mr. Feynman's attention. There were indications Mr. Feynman had not spent the last several months intensely interested in seeing him again. Mr. King did not know that anyone had ever been intensely interested in seeing him again. He had thought his admission would flatter Mr. Feynman, but that did not appear to be the case. "Yes," Mr. King went on, "the bloom begins to open at sundown and closes by dawn." When he learned of the nature of the party, Mr. Feynman was perturbed. "I'm not sitting here all night. I can only spend so much time watching a flower open. Then I have to move on to other things. I'm a man who likes a moving target."
"It's heartrending, isn't it?"
"Any flower that can only stay open one night should look for another job." The petals of the blossom trembled like the wings of a moth. The spreading flower gave off an aroma of honey and cloves and desert sun.
"What if we hadn't been here to witness it, Mr. Feynman?"
"A lot of the most beautiful moments pass unnoticed and unseen." Mr. King thought this was true and made the present event all the sadder, but Mr. Feynman, who made the observation, used it as an argument to mitigate the importance of such moments. Sugar Choo Choo handed them each a glass of sangria and said,
"We must all remember to speak in delicate whispers as the flower opens. Anyone who cannot speak in a delicate whisper on this most sacred occasion will be asked to leave and will not be invited back for next year's event. We want the blossom to know it is everything, It has but the one chance to show itself off.
Two rows of chairs were arranged in a semicircle around the plant. Mr. King took a seat next to Mr. Feynman.
"I have a very good view of the night-blooming Sirius from my seat," he said. "Still, I have many unfulfilled dreams."
At last, when Mr. King had nearly forgotten the thread, Mr. Feynman spoke up.
"A man your age should be able to reel off 4 to 5 dreams he's fulfilled like that." He snapped his fingers. "Otherwise, he's not a man. You know what I'm saying."
"Same for this boring blossom. You can't bloom once a year and call yourself keeping up your end of the bargain." Though Mr. Feynman was irritated, he kept his voice to an acceptable level. Mr. King's eyes burned, and his throat was so rigid he was unable to swallow. He ran his fingers repeatedly over his palms. Mr. Feynman leaned closer to him to seal the confidence and went on in the same impatient tone.
"Last month I had a lady in public, something I'd wanted to do for a very long time."
"And will you now marry the lady you had in public?" Mr. King said. Mr. Feynman pulled back and gave him a look as if Mr. King had said the most audacious thing possible. Mr. King did not comprehend his error. He sought to cover it by saying more, forgetting the cardinal rule that one should never say more to cover up an error of speech one has yet to grasp.
"Was she pendulous? Was that the appeal? Or soft and round?"
At this, Mr. Feynman threw his head back, clapped both hands to his broad chest, and laughed to the ceiling.
"The appeal was she was a lady, and it was dirty fun."
Mr. King looked around nervously at the other guests as though he were guilty of the disturbance. Sugar Choo Choo ran in from the kitchen, where she had gone to eat a spoonful of peanut butter on the sly. She tried to swallow quickly, but then had trouble freeing her tongue from the roof of her mouth. Instead of coming out,
"You have to leave, Daddy,"
the words sounded like,
"Muha tu wi, Addy."
Mr. Feynman grimaced at Mr. King. Mr. King felt himself to be the key to everything that was happening. It seemed perfectly natural that he would have to explain matters to Mr. Feynman.
"She wants you to leave, Mr. Feynman. I am afraid you are too loud for the flower.
I will leave with you if you'd like. It is embarrassing to get kicked out of a party by yourself. It is so much nicer when a companion gets thrown out with you. A bad reputation is best shared among friends." Mr. Feynman was so stunned to be kicked out of a night-blooming serious party by his own Sugar Choo Choo, he couldn't speak. He breathed rapidly and let Sugar Choo Choo guide him from his chair to the door. Mr. King followed them.
"I am afraid this is my fault, Carol," he said.
Sugar Choo Choo's legal name was Carol. Mr. King could not bring himself to call her Sugar Choo Choo. This was solely her father's prerogative.
"I don't understand the language of men, even though I am one. I asked your father a ludicrous question about a lady. The question was so ignorant of the ways of men, he couldn't help but bray like a wild donkey."
Sugar Choo Choo regarded Mr. King coolly and rotated her chin as she thought the problem through.
"If that is the case, Mr. King, then you must leave. My primary concern is the health of the blossom."
"I think we all want what is best for the blossom," Mr. King said.
"We are all rooting for it. It has such a short time on Earth."
Mr. Feynman drifted away in the direction of a young woman who was standing alone on the opposite side of the room. He had noticed her several times sneaking interested glances at the powerfully built, handsome older man that he was.
Carol was saying to Mr. King, "You have a fine, sensitive soul, but if you don't know how to speak the language of men, you should not sit next to one at a night-blooming serious party."
Ronald King approached to find out what the whispering was about and why Carol had not thrown her father out.
"Your father has admitted to being the real troublemaker, Ronald. He caused my father to forget all the rules of the Blossom Watchers. Therefore, he must go."
Ronald King shook hands with his father,
Please consider all that has happened, Dad, and learn from it.
At other events, it is fine to be raucous, just not at this one, Carol said. It will be like murdering a ministering angel if we don't give the Blossom all our concern.
Of course, Mr. King said. He bowed and left. When Mr. King's doorbell rang the next afternoon, he assumed it was Mr. Feynman stopping by to thank him for getting thrown out of the Night Blooming Sirius party on his behalf. Instead, it turned out to be Carol. She handed him a white Chinese food carryout box with a wire handle.
It is the shriveled blossom from last night, she said. I thought you would enjoy it.
So it did shrivel.
Right on schedule. Even though you misbehaved and got thrown out, I blaze a trail of reconciliation and peace by bringing you this ruined blossom.
Mr. King shook the limp petals from the Chinese carryout container onto his favorite blue saucer and placed the lot on his fireplace mantel.
How nice to have the very blossom Mr. Feynman watched open and drop off.
Daddy didn't watch this blossom open and drop. He left 5 minutes after you did.
Perhaps that is why he hasn't called to thank me and describe the evening.
He left with Miss Kwok.
Who is Miss Kwok?
A friend of mine he got friendly with.
I remember her. She didn't look like a Kwok.
She was adopted by Kwoks.
Mr. King was glad when Carol left so that he could be alone and think about how Mr. Feynman had taken Miss Kwok from the party with him.
I wonder what it means that Mr. Feynman took Miss Kwok from the party with him, he said aloud as he studied the pieces of the shrunken blossom.
How odd. It was so early in the evening, and there was so much more for the blossom to do.
The answer to Mr. King's question of what it meant that Mr. Feynman had taken Miss Kwok from the Night Blooming Sirius party came 2 weeks later when he received an invitation to their wedding.
How interesting, he said, turning the invitation over and over in his hands.
They must have had to leave the party to plan their wedding. Miss Kwok is probably the impatient sort who likes to get right on things once they're decided.
The front of the invitation was a painting done by Miss Kwok of a night-blooming Sirius flower. Inside, the invitation began, "Come witness the blossoming of our love." Miss Kwok was an artist, but not a very good one. Her blossom appeared as frazzled as the one on Mr. King's mantle. He wondered that Mr. Feynman would marry a lady who painted such poor blossoms, but perhaps Miss Kwok had other abilities.
Mr. King sat with Ronald and Carol at the wedding.
I could wring Miss Kwok's neck, Carol said, turning blue as Miss Kwok brought her dazzling smile down the aisle.
She's my age, 21. Daddy's twice as old. Good God, it's the equivalent of me going right now to the maternity ward and marrying a newborn.
Mr. King tried to calm her by telling Carol that she was already married to Ronald and that it was unnecessary for her to run to a nursery to marry a baby. He patted her wrist. She pulled away violently, determined not to be consoled. The wedding over, Mr. King joined his son and daughter-in-law in the reception line. When it came his turn to greet the groom, Mr. King grasped Mr. Feynman's hand with both his own. Looking into Mr. Feynman's blue-gray eyes, Mr. King began, unexpectedly, to cry. However, this sudden weeping did not embarrass him in the least. He managed to say what he wanted in spite of his sobs.
I hope you are not disappointed in Miss Kwok.
Mr. Feynman filled his chest with air to the point his buttons strained. His red face beamed with glory.
There is no more Miss Kwok. She is Mrs. Feynman now, as you saw happen just moments ago, my friend.
Mr. King's voice grew hoarse.
But don't you remember you once suggested we get married?
Yes, certainly, but not to each other. I made it quite clear at the time I meant to ladies.
But you didn't do a very good job of explaining that. You talked about the ladies of other nations.
I thought you did that because you were nervous for having suggested we get married.
I'm never nervous. Even now, I could look a tiger in the eye and keep a steady hand.
Mrs. Feynman had listened closely to her husband's conversation with Mr. King. She didn't know what to make of the man. She took both his hands from Mr. Feynman's as if they were about to do the Virginia reel, pulled him along, and said, "Thank you so very much for coming to our wedding. The cake is this way."
Mr. King noticed that Mrs. Feynman's eyes did not move in her head. They were stuck in one position. She had to turn her head completely to see different directions. When they reached the cake, Carol and Ronald turned on Mr. King. They were furious.
"You have no idea how much you embarrassed us back there," Carol hissed. "Do you understand nothing at all about social propriety?"
Mr. King sought to defend himself.
"Yes, but she is wall-eyed, your new mother. Her eyes don't move. They are stuck in one position like a teddy bear's eyes. How could you let your father marry a wall-eyed lady?"
"Don't you talk about my new mother that way. She is a lovely lady and has lovely eyes."
"But your mother wore fake leopard. This lady's eyes don't move, and she doesn't wear fake leopard."
"You don't know what you're talking about. Can you read the future? She might very well spend the rest of her days wearing fake leopard. She has yet to show her true colors."
Carol turned to Ronald, who had started in on the cake and was already neatly licking his fingers.
"Here, you deal with him. I wash my hands of your father."
She went off in search of cheese, saying that to her mind it was too early for cake. Ronald was angry too, but mostly at having to interrupt his cake eating, now that Carol had abandoned him, to berate his father. Seeing men cry made Ronald furious, as though he were watching the flag of America get shat upon. He leveled an icing-coated finger at Mr. King.
"Stop that right now, damn it!"
"I'm sorry, I'll try."
"You're odd. You're one of those persons that apologizes when he bumps into a mannequin."
Mr. King took his handkerchief from his breast pocket to dry his eyes, but the tears kept coming.
"Is it so wrong to apologize to a person before you realize he's synthetic? Most people will say a few more words even after they realize it's a mannequin. It's something in our nature, something in the way human beings are made. Just as our eyes keep blinking and our lips keep twitching for a while after our heads have been chopped off."
Ronald had so much cake in his mouth by the time Mr. King finished this little speech about chopped off heads that he had to go off to himself for several minutes to swallow. When he happened not to drift back Mr. King's way, but instead queued up at the champagne fountain, Mr. King looked around for someplace else to be. Everyone was beginning to ask who that crying man was, blocking access to the cake. Mr. King felt it wrong of him to draw all the attention when Mr. Feynman was really the most important person at the wedding. He spotted a group of five slumped women looking very glum indeed in their flancy, ill-fitting best. They sat in a dim corner of the room holding pieces of cake on their laps, though none of them was eating. Instead, each was in her private study, dejected and slightly sweaty, waiting for someone to deliver a sound justification for her being exactly who she was. Mr. King walked over to this somber group, the ones with the sick, wet eyes. With those sick, wet eyes, the five glanced lifelessly at him as he approached. In their failed efforts to appear stylish, they all looked slightly wilted, dowdy, like cuttings that had been left out in the garden bed overnight, forgotten and desiccating. "Are you five sisters?" Mr. King said. They did look vaguely alike, with a stair-step age range. They were not quintuplets, but could have been the work of active parents who had made a full family in 7 years before deciding, "Enough of that!" The oldest and tiredest-looking one, without taking her eyes off the floor, said, "Sisters?" "Of a sort." Mr. King made further use of his handkerchief. "Here, let me finish drying my eyes and then I will join your little group. I feel rather glum myself today.
It is hard to find a really depressed-looking group at a wedding, so I consider myself most fortunate. The five glanced at him as if he had said something slightly off color, but their interest was fleeting. One who could have been the middle sister said cynically, "Welcome to the corner of the rejects." Mr. King took a seat and crossed his legs and folded his hands on his knees. He was quiet for a minute. Then he said, "I was one of the rejects myself." He waited to be pumped for information, but apparently the five were worn out listening to each other's stories, and none of them more than sighed. "Yes," Mr. King went on, "Mr. Feynman once proposed we get married, but apparently he was not serious, for, as you see, he has now married Miss Kwok, which is what brings us all together at this time." The youngest one dropped her fork on the floor, but made no move to pick it up. After several more minutes, another reject lost control of her plate of cake, and the cake spilled on the floor, icing side down. In an effort to rouse the group and instill in it a feeling of solidarity, Mr. King said, "Maybe we should start a petition. That might help. Would anyone like to help me write it? We could all sign it and present it to Mr. Feynman and see what he says." Each of the rejects turned her head slightly away from him, but not so they were looking directly at any of the others. Though they were grouped together, they didn't want anything to do with one another, though each knew it would be even more painful not to be in a cluster. Mr. King sat all afternoon in the corner of the rejects, watching with the others, waiting for some reason to move on. The others drifted off one by one, leaving a crumpled napkin or a piece of brutalized cake in her seat. Some evidence to show she had lived and died an entire lifetime that day, and gone off to bury herself in her sorrow. But Mr. King remained. He saw the entire day out. The bride and groom left in a barrage of shouts and rice throwing. Mr. King watched and applauded, but wept too, having been told he was odd, a thing that had never occurred to him before. Carol and Ronald gave him a dutiful, disgusted glare and left without asking him if he wanted a ride home. The guests all left. The custodians and caterers cleared out. And finally, the man with the keys came to Mr. King and said, "I'm about to turn off the lights." Mr. King smiled up at him. "But I don't mind waiting." "Waiting?" "I don't mind waiting all night." "For what?" Mr. King had pounded out many conundrums in his long, lonely hours, but this was one of the meatiest bones he'd had to chew on. He'd be all night picking the gristle off this one. "Don't worry," he said to the key man. "I am used to sitting in the dark waiting for answers." He was being disingenuous. The answer had already come and gone and left him stranded. And the answer was Mr. Feynman. When the key man had knocked him off his chair, the key man was an impatient man, and there was something about Mr. King that made him want to hurt him. Mr. King said, "I'll never be the same," meaning never the same after meeting Mr. Feynman. But the key man thought Mr. King meant from the blow, so he hit him again. Only as he was picking up the pieces of himself did the thought occur to Mr. King that Mr. Feynman might have sent the key man to get rid of him. But he was immediately ashamed of himself for having thought such a thing of the man he would never see beyond.
David Vardaman was born and raised in Iowa and now lives in Portland, Maine. Stories from his collection, An Angel of Sodom, have appeared in Lit Break, Cardinal Sins, Adelaide, and Mystery Weekly. We asked David to sit down with us and talk about his work and some of his inspirations. And stay tuned after for when we hear from Rick Harsh about his new press, as well as a reading from his new novel. Here's David.
The stories in the collection An Angel of Sodom were written over the course of several years and in one instance over a decade ago, so any relation they bear to one another is purely accidental, inadvertent. They complement one another by virtue of the fact that they come of one single source, and looking at them now, I see that my people struggle with a sense of worthlessness that's both inborn and imposed and confirmed from the outside. And their efforts to struggle against that abiding feeling and of their contributions being beside the point in any given situation, of their perceptions being idiosyncratic and therefore painfully inappropriate to the conversations by which they try to connect with others, have darkly hilarious consequences and create the tonality that resonates across the work. And now, this is not a programmed technique I think about consciously or used to enliven a story, but organic to the way I think and see things. Only in the aftermath, after considering one story against another or others, do I come to see that this is what I'm about, and what manages to form the mysterious sea that supports my vessels. Mr. King in The Blossom Watchers is one of these single-minded characters. He's trapped in the idiosyncratic nature of the way he views situations, reality. And he appears all the more foolish in his comments and yearnings beside the point as he tries to make palpable the sincerity, the depth of his regard for Mr. Feynman. Now, Feynman has no interest in establishing the kind of rapport with Mr. King that Mr. King has come to regard as essential to his own happiness. Mr. King is the epitome of gentleness, a danger only to himself, but he applies pressure on Mr. Feynman of the sort Feynman finds irritating and finally ludicrous and laughable. Mr. King's efforts to give Feynman a sounding of his emotional pain give further evidence of what we might blithely term his being out of touch with reality, when in fact he is very much in touch with his own reality, a reality that defies convention and gives frank primacy, first place, to the heart in human affairs. I grew up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I was born in 1956, and though I've been away since 1976, except for the 2 years I attended graduate school in Iowa City in the early 90s, I still have not gotten past it, so to speak. I end The Blossom Watchers by describing Mr. Feynman as the man Mr. King would never see beyond, and I believe the same has come to prove true for me in Iowa. Now, a number of stories in An Angel of Sodom are set there, if not explicitly, then at least in my own mind. The geography of my hometown, the emotional content of my coming of age there, permeate the short novel An Angel of Sodom especially. I've heard it said that in the Midwest the landscape is in the sky, and the eye is certainly drawn there to the drama of it, to a contemplation of things large, cosmic, beyond one's control. The power and majesty of nature is in evidence there. It can be like a stage on which a great conflict is played out, and yet it can appear to be an empty stage too. You know, you look and watch for small indications that there are unseen forces marshaling their troops, little wisps of this and that that might be signs of greater things to come, about to mushroom, explode into view. I used the dramatic persona I found only in the sky explicitly in my story, Farm Girl, but I think this, what I'd call reverence for the power and sweep of nature, the privilege of seeing it growing and muscling up for scores of miles in advance, as one can in Iowa, informed my imagination in ways I can hardly begin to fathom or express. I can remember reading a newspaper article when I was about 8 about a tornado that took place in rural Iowa, and the article said something like, the white cloud touched down on the farm but did no damage. And about that time, I was learning about the Exodus in Sunday school, about how God guided the Israelites by day in a pillar of cloud. There was a flannel board picture of a towering white cloud leading a horde of people. The white cloud, of course, being the representation of God. And when I read the newspaper article about the white cloud touching down on the farm but doing no damage, I equated this with a visitation by God. I can't say that these mistakes that inform the psyche, the expectations and imagination of a child ever leave him. My story, Tramp on the Street, is set in an actual neighborhood bar that was within a stone's throw of my elementary school and a mere 2 blocks from our house, a positioning that I now find somewhat hilarious. It uses landmarks geographically appropriate to that neighborhood, at least as I last knew and as I remember it. And so that story harkens back to my childhood. The drunks speak of experiences I had as a child and or memories of conversations I heard in that place that was familiar to me, yet closed off to me at the time. Corona Samistat also has published my novel Suddenly This Summer, which is explicitly an Iowa novel set in Linn County in 1956, along with a companion but much shorter novel, April Is the Cruelest Month, which again uses Cedar Rapids landmarks and much disguised events from my early childhood there. George Salas, in the written interview, asked an interesting question, which you might want to include here. It's considering the title of your collection. What role does theology play in your fiction? So here's the answer I gave. We are told in my faith, which is Christian, that every human being and every created thing is of infinite and ultimate worth. We don't need religion to tell us this, but the sacred texts do emphasize this ethic while containing what I could only call horror stories, showing what happens when we act as though value is relative to utility. One's own feeling of utter worthlessness, which is a desecration to and a byproduct of one's being treated as a utility by other individuals and corporate entities, is as well opposed to the divine nature. Now, I'm no theologian, but the role God belief plays in my fiction is that my fragile beings, who cannot quite believe in their own value, look for that ministering angel to lead them out of Sodom, that byword for an inimical, inhospitable place, and make life bearable again for them, or as it never has been bearable for them before. Now, the angel can be a pet dog, a drink, the whitewashed memory of one's failures, the nearest madman, an act of violence. We're not very good judges of what is best for us in extremity. And granted, the options are often limited, and it seems that in desperate times, anything will serve.
Rick Harsh entered the American literary fray in 1997. With his Midwest noir cult classic, The Driftless Zone. This was followed by Billy Verite, and then The Sleep of the Aborigines, to make up the Driftless Trilogy. After attending the Iowa Writers' Workshop, Rick migrated to Slovenia, where he recently formed the imprint Corona Samizdat. Rick has published 3 books by David Vardaman, including the short story collection Angel of Sodom, in which Blossom Watchers appears. Here's Rick to give us an account of how it all came together, including bringing out 2 of his own brilliant novels, The Manifold Destiny of Eddie Vegas and the just-released Assassination of Olof Palme. Rick's interview is followed here by his reading of an excerpt from that very same book. Here's Rick.
It was an accident. Maybe that explains everything right there. What happened was, my publisher, which I won't name, Riverboat Books, after 2 years of some shady shit, I just said, you can't keep doing this to me. There were five actual dates that the Manifold Destiny of Eddie Vegas and Walk Like a Duck were going to come out. And what happened was, in April this year, I found out that by May, when it was supposed to come out, my publisher wasn't going to have the money that he kept saying he would have. And so they weren't going to... Well, what he wanted to do was put out the... he had like 15 or 16 advanced copies of The Manifold Destiny of Eddie Vegas. And I had a couple of reviews lined up for the publication date. And he was going to go to the publication date with... 15 or 16 copies of the book. And the reviewer who was, one of the reviewers who was doing it has a lot of followers. He's a YouTube reviewer who has a really intense following, and he sells books. And so I had this deadline, and it was important because I had a good reviewer who loved the book, The Manifold Destiny of Eddie Vegas. And I live in Slovenia. And I've had books published here, and so I have a bit of a network. And I called my publisher here and asked him if I've got the money, you know, what could we do? And I called him on a Sunday, and I had the books, large, beautiful copies of The Manifold Destiny of Eddie Vegas and Walk Like a Duck, a season of Little League Baseball in Italy, in my hands by Friday. 5 days. 5 days. And the prices weren't all that bad. Slovenia is a lot cheaper. That's a new word. We use it around the press. And this guy's got a small press, and, you know, so we did it. And I had him, but I thought, well, they're not going to be published by his press. So what am I? I got to have a press. So I came up with the name Corona/Samizdat. The reason for Corona is because of the coronavirus. I thought I better price things kind of low. There's a Corona discount that gave me a press. I forgot to tell you about Samizdat. Yeah, Samizdat, that means underground books in Poland and Russia. Underground books were called samizdat, which basically means self-made, self-published. But it has a different cachet. I was talking to this excellent writer I know, who's never been published, David Vardaman. He's a good friend of mine, and I thought, shit, man, he's got a book, An Angel of Sodom. That was the actual launch of the press, because I went under the... I started collaborating, an imprint. Corona Samizdat is an imprint of the press that used to publish me here, Amalietti and Amalietti. I decided, well, we got a press that can pretty much do whatever it wants, and I can do whatever I want. So the first thing I did was, after Vardaman, was I was going to publish a guy to save him from Riverboat. And what we ended up doing was Riverboat did publish him, but so did we. We did the World Edition with the blessing of Riverboat. And that's George Salas, and his book is called Sun Above, Sea Below. No, Sea Above, Sun Below. Yeah. I should know these things off the top of my tongue, but I'm just talking. I was gonna take care of every writer I knew who needed it, and I wanted to get Skulls of Istria back from Riverboat, and so I published Skulls of Istria in pocket form, and then I have three novels that were. I'm one of those writers who was lucky enough to be recognized by the French, but unlucky enough that the French behaved like U.S. publishers. Not badly, actually. They just went out of business. They went bankrupt shortly after they put out a second edition of two of my Driftless Trilogy books. And so so those books have been out of print for 15 years or so. So I did a one volume. We made a one volume Driftless Trilogy that was. It's a little brick of a book. Our pocketbooks are truly pocketbooks. You can really put them in your pockets, except for this one. It's too big. And Cynicism Management by Slovene writes in English named Bori Proper. Cynicism Management, another excellent book. Going about it the way we have, we also managed to show people that we did put out books. And although we don't have a good distribution system, we are selling, and all the money is going back into the books. When a writer makes up the cost of their print run, they get 25%. We got this terrific Canadian writer who's very highly regarded. Jeff Bercy's his name, but he's not a big seller. And he went with us, which is really great for our press. A book called Unidentified Man at Left of Photo, it uses all the tools of the metafictionalists, and it's a very, very, very clever and very funny book that takes place in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island in Canada. So he's a guy with a lot of connections. He's done a lot of reviews, and it's his third novel, and he went with us. But the biggest news now is a terrific novelist championed by Stephen Moore, a guy named Chandler Brassard, is completely out of print, and he died in 1993. But through Stephen Moore, I was able to get hold of his widow and get permission to publish his three best books. The one we've done already is called Raging Joy's Sublime Violations. And the next two are Wake Up, We're Almost There. And the one after that is As the Wolf Howls at My Door. Those latter two are big, funny, extraordinary works of literature that definitely deserve to be read. And I didn't want them, sooner or later, Brassard's going to make a comeback. And what's going to happen is the books are going to be out of print, and book dealers are going to be selling them for Alexander Theroux prices, like Darkinville's Cat, or Marguerite Young prices, or Miss McIntosh, My Darling. You know, everything's from 80 to hundreds. And actually, there are some Brassard books out available for one I saw for £2,000. Well, we printed his short anti-Vietnam book, Raging Joys, in pocket form for 10 euros. And the others will be in the low 20s because they're very expensive to make. We've got a second book out by Vardaman that's called Suddenly This Summer, because that's one of the novels. It's a flip book. There are two novels. One starts on one side, one's on the other. Suddenly This Summer, and then on the other side, April is the Cruelest Month. They were written 10 years apart, and it's fascinating because Suddenly This Summer, although it has the Vardamanian oddity, it doesn't have as much freakish, bizarre, absurd as his newer stories. April is the Cruelest Month is a very cruel story, but you are complicit because you will laugh. And there's just these startling moments and these digressions, and the people in them are semi-recognizable. I don't think that's the best way to put it, because they're fully recognizable, and yet much of what they do and say is unexpected and strange, but they're human all the same. Maintenance Ends is going to do some great things, and it's off to a great start. You know, you're going to be in the peripheral regional, meaning people who don't fit in anywhere are all over the place in every region, and they're recognizably regional, and yet it's a brotherhood and sisterhood that I've found that even here in Isola, Slovenia, we have people who, or situations and people who are just like they are in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and in Iowa. Europeans, to the extent we know what we are talking about here, are fond of saying that whilst they abhor America, they are generous enough to like the individuals hatched there. If I may speak for those of us without a continent of our own, and be excused for what you misconstrue as bitterness, we feel that there is no point in despising a people if we don't despise the people comprising those people. I may not be an Albanian, I assure you, and we all hate Albanians, if you need to be reminded. But we all of us know and love some of them. Even the most frothless despiser of Albanians has been caught off guard liking a fellow who turns out to be Albanian. But so as not to be a hypocrite, we, will determine that a certain Albanianism is lacking in this particular specimen. Surely this one does not clean his ass with the same filthy water day after day, wiping with the same unwashed hands we have just embraced with our own, kissing his spotless face thrice upon greeting, and if he is reproducing at 17 times the local rate, surely the intent is not to acquire our apartment, for we have seen with our own eyes that he has a swell enough apartment of his own. If he were to colonize my birthright by birth record, he would hardly be sending half his paycheck back to Albania, where they, as he has told us humbly, as if it were a slip, all drive a Mercedes, which is where the real paperwork prestidigitation is necessary at those pauperous prices. But an American is no person. Even where he's a minority, he can't even manage that. Maybe he's an individual, but hardly a person. Nah. He's a peacekeeper and a bomber, a target picker and a panderer, a spy, a slaver, an advance man, an opportunist, a derelict dandy, a money changer, a Christ killer, a fiend, a lopo, a barabbas, a Roman, a sadist, an asswipe, a bootlick, a stool pigeon, a fart sniffer, a computer terrorist, an extortionist, a pestilence, a tsetse fly, a ripe turd, a secular pederast, a market manipulator, an oil man, a Texan, a drawing down home damnum fatale, a gravedigger, a buzzard, a ball buster, a blusterer, a blowhard, a recrudescence, a redundancy, a shithouse stain, a collapsible shelter, a mongerer, a mongoloid, a mongol, a menace, a martinet, a myrmidon, a withering zeitgeist, a grotesque Waldschmerzer, making merrily away into the night with your mistress, an abomination to, an accessory to, a situational chimera, a proud perfidy, a vagitus, a prevaricator, a varix of the mindscape, a limpid dick in a scum pond, a margrave in a sewer, a caprophagite, a bescumberer, a diuretic, a creature of habit, a tool, an agomphius gobbling gourmet of graft, a shithead, a real fucking shithead. Never mind if he's a moron, he's still a detumescence of humanity, one-eyed scepter of the scum pond, an indisputable desquamation, a compulsively defecation, rabies, distempered, a lupine, lunk-headed lord of a laissez-faire laloplegia, a dung diver, a donkey's ass, an ass's dong, an ink pen plague, a serial killer, a momentum, a grab your ass, a tick on the face of the globe, a tumor, a cancer, a bursitis, an advanced rheum, a frenetic arthritic, a traveling salesman, a yes man, a naysayer, a nabob, a billy bob, a deflated boob, an electronic dartboard, a computerized jukebox, a handcuffer, a torturer, a worm, a rat, a squealer, a profiteer, an encloser, a bandy leg, a marfan, a class issue, a plainsman, a maggot, a carcass and a maggot, a stick in your eye, an obelisk in the sentence of history, an hysteria in the belch of time, a fargolator, an obituarial factotum, the breath of Satan, the sulfur of Sodom, the shame of God, the indisputable of Bogdeyebosari, a red herringbone, tar baby suit, a suit passing for a man, a haircut passing for a suit, a suitcase passed to a client, a flagellator, a hurricane of cause and effect, a hoary can of tuna, a whore hefting the fasces of Fata Morgana, a boar sucking the feces of a fat Congo Bwana, that is to say, a Lumumba slayer sucking at the tit of an elephant Tiasine Tsitsiseko, a gaffer, a troll, a gargoyle, a new therianthropic dinar is served, a thyroid hormone, a fetid pheromone, a steroid glutamus, a phlegmon, a gog magog magog gag ye whilst a magyar rape your sister, a bahinchut, a bonehead, a bean counter, a cunt slapper, a hypocrite, a sanguinal purulence, a carpet butterer, a sarcophagus, a tuber and a tubercule, a laugh, a lung, so laugh along alone, a tweezer, a persisting geezer, a gook killer, a nigger hanger, a spick spanker, a wop wanker, a wog swallower, a wife beater, a Don Cheney, a Lon Cheney, a Henry Kissinger, a home wrecker, a hands-off phrenologist, a fallen seaman, a fang cherub, a deserted island in a sea of troubles, a gonorrheal politicker, a gunboat diplomatist without a degree, a perforation, a scurvy, a blight, a bloat, a beaver shooter, a groping uncle, a carbuncle, a furuncle, a regulatory system, self-help, guru, a grandee, a narcissist, a floating egg, a dangling modifier, a migraine, a Steppenfelchit, a spider, a tychophage, a finicky sponge, a tendentious cretin, a cartocephalic, a magnum carter, a fugger, a neo-Hanseatic, a sword swallower, an amicidal trail of amentia, a suckwad, a territory tout, a mugger, a shambling mockery, an urgent call to octogenarial on-down abortion, a dank crotch, a fragged ghost, a milk toast, a tepid sip, an acidic esophagus, a torment, an ugly, a stacked deck, a three-note fart, an Octavian, a Caligula, a zero, a farce to be wrecked herewith, a bloat-headed baby raper banging his head on an altar, a tall tale told by a first-person idiot in sonic boom obduracy, signifying nothing left, a poison mushroom, a cloud, a kurtz, a klutz, a kaputsker, a kibitzer of cultures, a rectum with sphincter of invidious force, a real strangler that, a xenophop, a bucket of slop, a toad, the warts on same, a carcinomic alembic, a cyclops looking the other way, a futuristic anachronism, a poxymoron, a scree, a doppelganglia, a synapsed, an unrequited cinephile, a phlogist, a scroff's terrier, an effete fungus, a Calipernian seer, a defiling rod, a rung cock, a flung cock, a monk's ox, a barrel of lapsus, a terrible crappiness, a mountebank, a dirtball, a pissant, a stomp on a bum, a far-gone conclusion, a Delphi delusion, overt intrusion, a handkerchief passing for a man, a gaff a minute, a pinhead, and a pallbearer, a shrike, a liaison, a lesion making haste to infection, an adhesion, see stain, a stasis in the wrong places, a spurdy can, a democrat, a demo, a crassus, a croesus, a thermoplier, a bob to the surface, a Mickey Finn, a sanitary puck of fluorescent green in a yellowing puddle at a roadside piss room urinal, a cheatnik, a stasher, a terrorist, a pimp, a pusher, an insurance agent, a spent karma salesman, a tumbledum, a ruse of a rube, a reason to rant, to rave, to riot, to rise, to raise, to rip, tear, and throttle, to wreak revenge. I don't like them.
Thank you for joining us for the third episode of Serial City. Sorry, no discussion of breakfast cereal in this episode. We will make up for that next time. The work of several fine artists was featured in this episode: Luminous by Epitome Zero, Nocturnal by Chad Crouch, Cinnamon Teal by Chad Crouch, Where the Red Lion Walks by Nikki Cook, The Red Room Curse by Filmy Ghost, Good Vibes by Jay Blankt, Drone Improvisation by Abish High. Join us next time for Serial City.